Hey gang, it's Todd Zwillick in for Joshua Johnson. This conversation was recorded earlier today. Follow your NPR member station for the latest or visit npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson today. Disbarred attorney Michael Cohen will soon report to prison for the start of his three-year stretch for crimes that he says were at the direction and in the defense of President Donald Trump. But first, he spent 3 days on Capitol Hill talking to lawmakers about his former relationship with the president. He was cheered by some, scolded by others, and questioned by many. The president has called Michael Cohen a rat. But what came out of all this testimony? Meanwhile, the House worked to block President Trump from building a border wall by declaring a national emergency. And elections in Chicago and North Carolina's 9th congressional district heated up this week. But it was a very busy few days. There's a lot to discuss here on the News Roundup. Let's waste no time. Let's introduce our guests for the News Roundup. Shane Harris is an intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post. He's also a Future of War Fellow at the New America Foundation and author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Shane, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
Also with us, Anita Kumar. She's White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me back.
Wendy Benjaminson is back. She's tax editor for Bloomberg. Wendy, welcome.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
All right, gang, let's get to it because it was riveting congressional testimony, a hearing, maybe the most riveting that we've seen in a long time on Capitol Hill. The former personal attorney and fixer for Donald Trump was in front of Congress on Wednesday. Michael Cohen spent about 8 hours behind closed doors with the House Intelligence Committee yesterday, where the issue of the president's use of pardons apparently came up. So let's stipulate what we already know about Michael Cohen. We know he has credibility problems. We know he's been convicted for lying to Congress and for violating campaign finance laws. He's going to prison for it. We also know that he worked for Donald Trump for 10 years, fixed a lot of things that Donald Trump wanted fixed, and was in the room for a lot of conversations. So, Shane, what did we learn from at least the public hearing from Michael Cohen that we didn't know before?
Well, there are some pretty significant things, I think, that we didn't know. He also added to our understanding of some things we did know. In the realm of things that we hadn't heard, he now says that Donald Trump knew in advance that WikiLeaks was set to release emails that were going to be damaging to the Democratic Party and to Hillary Clinton. He claims that he was in the room when Trump's secretary patched through Roger Stone, who figures prominently in this saga as well, and Trump put him on speakerphone, and Cohen heard Stone conveying to then-candidate Trump that he'd been in touch with WikiLeaks and there were emails coming. So that kind of fixes now, according to Michael Cohen, Donald Trump with some kind of prior knowledge about these efforts that were ultimately being directed by Russia. There may not be a legal predicament for him there, but certainly politically that changes our understanding. He also talked about the payment of the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, her real name is Stephanie Clifford, and showed actual checks that Donald Trump had signed himself while he was serving as president and relayed a conversation that he'd had with Trump in the Oval Office where Trump said, "Don't worry, Michael, the check's in the mail," effectively.
And says he can provide many more checks signed by the president and by people in his family.
By the president and by the president's son. So now ultimately we also have Donald Trump Jr. And another person, Alan Weisselberg, who I'm sure will come up in our conversations today, the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, as people being involved in what Cohen testified was a criminal conspiracy that he's already pleaded guilty to in the Southern
District. All right, so let's stop there. We will get to Alan Weisselberg for sure, because one thing we're going to talk about is the roadmap going forward. Anita, here's Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings just after the hearing. He was asked by reporters in the hallway on Capitol Hill if there's evidence now that Donald Trump committed crimes while he was president, while in office.
Based on what you heard, do you believe that the president committed a crime while in office?
It appears that he did. I mean, again, that's not for me to say. I'm basing that on what has already been filed.
Anita Kumar, what does that mean if the chairman of the Oversight Committee says it appears the president committed crimes while in office?
It's not good. the House Democrats have been wanting to investigate, and this is just the beginning of what they're going to do. So we're going to be talking about this, but you heard a ton of names of people that they want to bring in, a lot of documents that they want. The White House has resisted. The federal agencies have resisted. And I just think that this is the beginning. They were taking a lot of notes on things that they want to know in the future. I thought it was really interesting during the testimony, several of the things that Michael Cohen kind of said, but either Democrats didn't push on it or there was no answer. There are other investigations. He hinted at that, but he didn't say what they were. There are other hush money payments, or so he said, but we don't really find out what those are. There are a lot of other things to know, and I just think we know them, but I think Democrats are really going to try to figure out what those are.
And many questions that he refused to answer, saying that's one of the places where I can't talk about it because SDNY, the Southern District
right.
of New York, or Robert Mueller have,
right.
have asked
me and to be clear that Congress, the Democrats, don't want to interfere with those investigations, but there's still plenty of things that they could try to know.
Wendy, one of the lies that landed Michael Cohen in prison was saying that the president's pursuit of a Trump Tower Moscow, which needed Vladimir Putin's approval, by the way, did not extend into the 2016 election. That appears to not be true, and it was a big part of the hearing.
That's right. What Cohen had said was that it ended right in January of 2016 when the Republican primaries were really going on in full force. And now it turns out those negotiations were going on until June, and which is well into the primaries were over. Trump was the nominee or close to being the nominee. And so that is a huge difference. That means his personal finances were inextricably linked with his pursuit of the White House. If anyone thinks that there is a difference in Vladimir Putin's mind between a business deal and foreign policy, that would be a mistake. So I think the upcoming hearings and where Felix Sater may be involved, because he is a Russian-born, now American businessman who was involved in those negotiations, and I think bringing him before Congress will be very interesting.
Well, let's talk about Felix Sater. I'm glad you went there, Wendy, because lawmakers do want to talk to him now. Felix Sater is a businessman with close ties to the Russian mob, as has been widely reported in our press. He's a financial fixer, a former inmate in federal prison, who Donald Trump claimed in a deposition to barely know. Well, here's Democratic Congressman Harley Ruta questioning Michael Cohen about Felix Sater.
Isn't it true that because of Mr. Sater's relationship to the Trump Organization, that he had an office in the Trump Tower?
And on the 26th floor, Mr. Trump.
And the 26th floor is important. Why?
Because it's Mr. Trump's floor.
And isn't it also true that convicted Russian mobster Sater even had business cards indicating that he was a senior advisor to Donald Trump, as reported by the Washington Post?
Yes.
Based on those facts, isn't it true that President Trump misled at best, or worse, lied under oath?
Yes.
Reminder there that President Trump had said in a deposition earlier, Shane, that he would have to have his memory jogged. I barely know the guy. Don't really know Felix Sater. Remind us who exactly he is. Wendy gave us a brief primer, but why he's important now.
Well, Sater works at this company, or at the time called Bayrock, which, as Michael Cohen indicated, had offices there in Trump Tower. He is sort of the connective tissue, if you want to think about it, between the Trump Organization and the efforts to get this Moscow Tower deal done. So he's a very important figure working with Michael Cohen. There's a lot of documentary evidence about messages that they were exchanging about how they could get this deal going. Sater at one point bragging about how he could help get Donald Trump elected president. So when you're talking about Trump and the efforts to build a tower in Moscow, Felix Sater is a key person in that equation.
Felix Sater's also been reported to have been key in fixing a lot of financial deals, real estate deals, where rich Russians wanted to park money in American real estate, and the American they found with parking spaces was Donald Trump.
Right. And Felix Sater, we should also note, has talked extensively, we understand, from reporting to the FBI, and has provided a lot of information about those kinds of transactions and activities. So if you're looking for someone potentially who could speak to not just the Moscow Tower deal, but other kinds of arrangements or connections between Trump Organization or Trump properties and Russia, Felix Sater is a person who could do that.
What about his willingness to cooperate? Has he given indication? You said he has talked to federal investigators. Has he given any signals whether he's ready to spill all the beans, ready to be called a rat by Donald Trump, or hide the ball, or potentially risk perjury like others have?
Well, I think that based on his past interactions with the FBI in particular, he's probably more than willing to provide information. I think he's done that already in a number of contexts. Chairman Adam Schiff on the House Intelligence Committee, which is going to hear his testimony, tried a little bit to downplay expectations yesterday, saying don't necessarily expect a hearing with quite the same fireworks as Michael Cohen. But when you have somebody with this level of knowledge about Donald Trump, his finances in Russia, testifying, pretty much anything he has to say stands the chance of being revelatory and really compelling.
And remind me just very quickly, how far back do they go, Felix Sater and Donald Trump?
A number of years. We're talking like well before Donald Trump was ever, I don't know the exact year, but well before he was ever a serious candidate for office.
Well, we got this tweet from AC Monroe who says, the fact that Cohen isn't going to change the minds of any Republicans, the fact is, they know that Trump is a criminal and they don't care. He got them their Supreme Court justice. He got other lower court appointments. So they don't care what he does at this point. They will never go against their God. And one thing that struck me during the hearings, you know, Republicans really went at Michael Cohen for his credibility. You're a liar. You can't be trusted. You lied to Congress. Nothing you say is credible. You're a profiteer. You want to write a book and make money. Really going after his dishonesty. And he has lied about things. That's why he's going to jail. But lingering just behind those accusations, and it struck me, is the fact that Michael Cohen's lies were all in the service of protecting his boss, their guy, Donald Trump. And that lingers just half a step behind the accusations of what a criminal and now a convicted felon Michael Cohen is.
Yeah, I have to say, I've been saying the same thing for 2 years, which is these riveting, controversial things keep happening in Washington with Donald Trump. And it's exactly what this listener is saying, which is it's not changing a lot of minds. Republicans largely still support the president. Democrats largely still criticize him. But we did learn things from Michael Cohen. We learned more details about things I think we already knew. So more specifics. But I think it didn't change a lot of minds. Now, that's not to say things won't come out in further investigations, and we might see where that goes. But if you were for President Trump, you're still for him. And if you were against him, you still are. I talked to a lot of people that are close to the White House afterwards, and I think there was a little bit of a relief that there was information. He talked for a very long time. There were some new details, but there wasn't a huge bombshell. And they said it was sad. He talked a lot, but it's pretty much the same.
Still, it can be a little hard to digest, at least for this journalist, watching Michael Cohen be excoriated for being a liar, and that he is under oath, for lying, for instance, saying the Trump Tower Moscow deal ended in June. There was nothing after June. That's a lie. He's going to jail for it. The next thought is Donald Trump and the Trump campaign were talking to Russians about a multimillion-dollar deal while he was campaigning for president. That part went unsaid.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, he did. When he came up there, they knew this was going to be a hard sell, right? He did lie. He's going to prison because he lied. But did he come across somewhat sincere? He did. I think he did. If you'll remember at the end of the hearing, he got, he had tears in his eyes. He seemed sincere, but the Republicans always can go back and say he's a liar.
Well, forget about the tears. Michael Cohen also had receipts, because I think Michael
Yes.
Cohen knows that his tears aren't worth too much anymore, but signed canceled checks may be.
And the other thing is, of course, he's name dropped 10 people or 15 people that can, he says, corroborate what he says.
And so let's go right there from where we were to where exactly we're going, Wendy Benjaminson, because there's a lot of bluster at these hearings. We've all been to them. But freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York City pursued a very direct and succinct line of questioning that elicited some real information from Michael Cohen. It was all about Donald Trump's financial dealings before becoming president.
To your knowledge, did the president ever provide inflated assets to an insurance company?
Yes.
Who else knows that the president did this?
Alan Weisselberg, Ron Lieberman, and Matthew Calamari.
And where would the committee find more information on this? Do you think we need to review his financial statements and his tax returns in order to compare them?
Yes, and you'd find it at the Trump Org.
Wendy, there's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez right there getting from Michael Cohen that there may be a crime. Here's who to ask. Here's what you should subpoena. And here's where to find it. All in that clip. Let's start with Alan Weisselberg. Remind us who he is and why Congress now wants to talk to him.
Well, he is one of the senior executives or the executive of the Trump Organization, which is the large company that runs all of Donald Trump's properties all over the world, and apparently was deeply involved in, helping with all the deals and was working very closely with Michael Cohen for that. And it's just fascinating the way AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, just gave these quick prosecutorial questions with none of the political bluster that you get from veterans in both parties. She asked the question, and Cohen, who apparently is very experienced now at giving depositions, just answered them, I mean, without any rhetoric, too.
Shane Harris, this is what people are calling a roadmap now, one of the roadmaps of where Congress is likely to want to go here.
That's right, because now you have somebody who was on the inner circle, Michael Cohen, saying these are the other people in the inner circle and these are the things that they're likely to know about. And we should remember, too, that we're only hearing about this in part 2 years after President Trump has come into office because Republicans controlled this committee that Cohen was appearing before and did not investigate these things. They didn't look into the Trump Organization. So you're hearing names of people that I think a lot of reporters who are familiar with the Trump Organization have heard in the past. But this really is news to a lot of the American public who've never heard it straight from the lips of somebody like Michael Cohen saying these are the three or four people you have to go ask. They will know about these particular issues. It's been a lot of suspicion, allegation, but never something that has been on the record like this in a congressional hearing. And I think thinking of it like a roadmap is the way to look at this. This is Cohen essentially telling investigators in Congress where to go and what they might find.
Robert in Saugatuck, Michigan writes, to my point and to your point, Anita, the Republicans lost all credibility focusing their attention on Cohen's past lies to Congress, totally ignoring who he was lying for. And Randy in Tulsa writes quite fairly, let's be clear, that testimony won't change any Democratic minds either. Now, let's get back to Alan Weisselberg, CFO of the Trump Organization, the keeper of the keys to the files and the financial transactions of the Trump Organization going back, I'm not sure how long, but it's at least 20 years. More than 40, okay.
He was first employed by Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump.
Fred.
So he's been in the family business for 45 years.
And that would make him in the family business, as the New York Times reported, when Fred Trump was busy transferring about $400 million of his wealth to Donald Trump through what the New York Times says are some elaborate and illegal tax schemes using buildings in Queens.
Right. I mean, he's involved in, has been involved in every major, maybe minor, financial transaction at the Trump Organization. But not just that, some of Donald Trump's personal business, the Trump Organization, his tax returns. He is one of the two people, and the other one is the son, that are on the president's trust that he amended to put those two people on after he became president.
Now, Alan Weisselberg has immunity from prosecution with the Justice Department. How does that bump up against his future testimony in Congress, raising his right hand, testifying under oath? He can't be prosecuted, I guess, for specific things, but he could be prosecuted for lying to Congress, or how does that work?
There's a lot of confusion about what kind of immunity he has and what kind of cooperation he has. It has, every time someone is reported to have cooperation, everybody thinks it's on everything, and he's going to spill the beans on every single thing. We believe, we have heard that it's very small. It's just about Michael Cohen and this issue with the hush payments to these women who say they had affairs with Donald Trump. So a very small thing. It could be larger, but that is what the president and the people close to the president think it is. They think it's very minor. And here's how we know that they think it's minor. Alan Weisselberg is still working at the Trump Organization. He's not going to be going to work every day on the 26th floor of Trump Tower if he's actually cooperating on a wide variety of things.
So, Wendy, if it's true that Alan Weisselberg's immunity is limited to the hush money payments, the payments for which Michael Cohen displayed a canceled check in the hand of Donald Trump and says he has 10 more, right? 11 in total. One of the checks was for 2 months, not one. If it's true that his immunity is limited to that, from AOC's questioning, that indicated that now Congress is interested in a lot of other things besides hush money payments, things that, as she elicited from Michael Cohen, would require the viewing of Donald Trump's tax returns.
That's right. That's right. And as we all know, the Congress, Democratic now-led Congress, is working very hard to get to figure out how they can get Donald Trump's tax returns, which, you know, one thing to caution is that there's not going to be a line item in Donald Trump's tax returns that says check to Vladimir Putin, you know, $2,000 or check to Alan Weisselberg.
Right. Free bird seat here.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to be very, very complicated. The checks that Michael Cohen talked about could very well be under a line that says, you know, legal services that could be perfectly legitimate legal services and maybe not so legitimate legal services. But, yes, I think that Congress now is going to go after everything that Donald Trump has ever done or said. And he was tweeting about it this morning himself, saying that that is what Congress is doing.
Well, a listener in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, writes us an email that says it's not about Republicans who support Trump or Democrats who hate Donald Trump. It's all about the independents. Now, that's the political side of this. We're talking about the legalities and the investigations. But, Wendy, it makes me wonder. Mitch McConnell and other Republicans have talked about presidential harassment. They're pointing to this feeling that if you go after Donald Trump too much, voters might get sick of it. They might turn against you for investigation upon investigation upon investigation.
Well, and it's not just Mitch McConnell. Even Nancy Pelosi is concerned that the talk of impeachment, the talk of just, you know, as I said earlier, turning over every rock in Donald Trump's backyard and trying to find something could turn off moderate voters. It could turn off independents, the people who are neither all the way in Trump's camp or all the way in the Trump hater camp. So there is a real danger there. And I think the leadership on both sides is aware of that.
Anita, Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, said yesterday after Michael Cohen's closed door testimony, classified, that Michael Cohen is coming back in just about a week, less than a week. Do we have a sense of what's left to know from him? Apparently transcripts, I'm sure redacted, maybe coming at some point. That makes reporters excited.
It does. Well, we don't want the
redactions,
right? Exactly. I mean, it's clear from his public testimony the other day that there are so many things that they want to know. Remember also that even though Russia did come up in the public testimony, they were largely leaving that to the intelligence committees. So we can imagine that that took a very long time, or that is going to take, you know, an enormous amount of time that we didn't see in the public testimony. So there's going to be a lot of details on that.
I want to make sure we get to another related, separate issue over at the White House that broke just yesterday. Shane Harris, the New York Times reported and the Washington Post followed that the president ordered that Jared Kushner's security clearance be granted. This was after security officials and intelligence officials who do the reviews on top secret security clearances flagged it and said Jared Kushner shouldn't have one. That's the bottom line. Now, we knew that they said that. We knew that Jared Kushner got one. Now we learn the president ordered it.
Right. And that is the key thing that's different here. We knew, we had reported and others had as well previously, that he ultimately did get this clearance. And what we were told, including by his attorney, Abby Lowell, is that everything followed the normal procedure, which suggested that, okay, Jared Kushner, who had all of these very well understood problems that might prevent him from getting a clearance, was ultimately able to overcome that and give a clearance. That we assumed meant that people in a position of authority said, okay, you should grant it to him. Now what we know is that his father-in-law came in, overruled those professionals whose job it is to assess whether someone is a security risk and therefore should not have access to the kind of material and intelligence that Kushner wanted, and said, give it to him anyway. And importantly, then Chief of Staff John Kelly was so upset by this that he documented the moment in a memo, right? This is the time of contemporaneous memos by senior officials, I guess, essentially saying this happened, the president ordered me to do it. We know that John Kelly had been very against circumventing the process and had concerns about Kushner getting a clearance.
Now, the president has the power to grant a clearance to whomever he wants. It appears the story here is that he lied about it. He told the New York Times that he had nothing to do with this process. Ivanka Trump said the exact same thing. That appears to not be true.
Yeah, that's not true.
Yeah. I mean, and he didn't have to lie about it.
No, he didn't have to. Look, the president is what's called the original classification authority, which means he can give a clearance to anyone who wants. The information is classified literally at his authority.
So now the big issue going forward is Jared Kushner is operating on the world stage. He's talking, having some of the most sensitive conversations imaginable from a national security standpoint. And according to our intelligence officials, my word, not theirs, he is potentially compromised by his financial dealings, by his relationships, by his meetings, etc. So I'm dying to know this, Shane. How does this work now? The president says, okay, he gets a clearance. Security officials say he shouldn't have one, so he's going to get it. Do they now go to him and sit down and say, Mr. Kushner, look, the president has decided this fine. If they mention, if the Qataris, I'm making it up, mention this deal, or if MBS mentions this loan, be very careful because you're vulnerable here and they might be trying to get to you, or do they just wash their hands and say, it's a free-for-all?
Well, they won't necessarily warn him about anything that others might say. So he has a top-secret clearance. We should emphasize, though, he does not have what are called sensitive compartmented information clearances. So if you like, above top-secret. So there are some things that are still being withheld from him, information that might be gleaned from spies or from communications intercepts. What would probably would be more likely is that the information that he is going to be getting might be restricted or, if you like, pared down in some way. But I don't think a security official would come to him necessarily because of this security clearance issue and brief him anything on they might say. Now, they might tell him ahead of a meeting in what's called a defensive briefing, you know, be aware if the following things are said, here's what we really know. But there, too, they might be restricted in what they can tell him about what we really know.
So
the
they might hold back information from him. But in the real world, does it mean somebody keeps an eye on him? Because he's vulnerable?
In the real world, I think practically what's happened is that he has been a person of concern to intelligence and security officials since the day he stepped in the White House, and that now he has a top secret clearance at the president's direction, and there's not much you can do about that.
Anita?
I was just going to say that there's no way to diminish how important he is. He is now sort of the de facto chief of staff for the president, so he's involved in everything.
Everyone else has left.
Everyone's left. Mick Mulvaney is acting chief of staff, but we have been told that he is pretty much doing everything.
The Democratic-controlled House passed two gun control measures this week. One requires background checks for all firearm transfers. That's universal background checks, even between private parties. The other bill would close the so-called Charleston loophole. Current law allows a gun sale to proceed after 3 days, even if the background check hasn't been done. This bill would extend that period to 10 days. What is the House done here, and is this going anywhere?
Well, there is no surprise at all that they took it up. I mean, honestly, there's only a surprise it took 2 months for them to get to it. This is something they campaigned on, that Democrats have been talking about. They have wanted to change the gun laws for a long time. It was largely on party lines. Largely, a few Republicans voted for the measures. It will go nowhere in the Senate. And it's the Trump era, and so I hate predicting anything, but I'm going to predict it's not going to go anywhere in the Senate. Republicans in the Senate will not pass this. But the House Democrats felt really strongly that they should put it out there, that they said they would do this, and then they're doing it.
Universal background checks got close after the disaster at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut when it was put on the Senate floor. A lot of coverage of that. The Sandy Hook parents came to the halls of the Senate. It didn't pass then. And you're saying if it didn't pass then, it's not going to pass.
Yeah, remember
now.
Back then, Barack Obama and Vice President Biden pushed so hard. This was in the second term after Sandy Hook. This was a major initiative for them. And they pushed hard. And if a sitting president, Democratic president, couldn't get it done, it's definitely not happening now.
We had Wendy and author on this show just a couple of weeks ago who was writing about the students of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School and their political activity over the next year. And one of his points was you can't see it yet in a lot of the votes, maybe, but people, American voters, are starting to vote on the issue of guns. He pointed to a couple of races in the midterms. I don't know if you agree with that or if you see any future, without making rank predictions, about whether Americans are actually preparing to vote on this issue, because many of them, except people who care hardcore on either side, really haven't.
That's true. And a very quick caveat, the owner of my news organization has spent his personal time and money on gun control issues, but separate from that, on the news side, I think there are, whether it's creeped up to the Republican Senate or not yet, I think in the American mainstream, there are people who can see reasonable control measures like background checks, like a cooling off period, who can see that as a reasonable measure. When you look at how the people who have committed these mass shootings got their weapons, of course, this legislation is only as good as the mechanisms that make it happen. Remember, the Air Force failed to tell the FBI that the shooter of that church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, had been dishonorably discharged for violent acts with guns. That would have prevented him from getting a gun and committing that shooting.
I want to move us out of Washington. I want to go to Chicago, where there was a mayoral runoff this week. And the two people who came out on top, both African-American women. And that means that Chicago will have its first African-American female mayor. Lori Lightfoot is one candidate. Tony Preckwinkle is the other. They're going to be in a runoff after the election that was in that was on Tuesday. Chicago voters will decide between these two candidates in April. Shane Harris, can you bring us up to speed on the race in America's second city?
Yeah, so there's one big surprise here is that Bill Daley did not finish enough to actually go to the runoff.
I've heard that name before.
You've heard that name before, so maybe being part of a political dynasty isn't the advantage that people once thought it was in American politics. I suppose you could ask the Clintons about that as well, and the Bushes. But yes, you can have these two candidates, Lightfoot and Preckwinkle, the latter being, I think, a more well-known figure in Chicago politics, the former being a former U.S. assistant U.S. attorney. But it does create this historic kind of moment. Lightfoot would actually be the first openly gay mayor in the history of Chicago, too, which is notable. And I think it's such an interesting window, I thought, into the way that our presumptions about how politics and entrenched politics and dynastic politics, if you will, are changing. I think that Lightfoot seems to be the one that maybe has a little bit of an edge in the polling, journalists should be out of the prediction business when it comes to elections, as far as I'm concerned. But this is going to be historic no matter which
way it
goes.
It'll be historic. Why didn't Rahm run?
That's a good question. I think maybe he was ready to move on. People thought that he was going to be there for yet another term, but maybe he too has decided that there are greener pastures ahead and didn't want to go in this time.
Let's fly down to North Carolina and the 9th Congressional District. We're now in the suburbs, I believe, of Charlotte, North Carolina. And the reason we're going there is because a board that was called to reevaluate the congressional election in the Chicago 9th District last week said that a new election must be called. Why? Because of fraud and ballot tampering with absentee ballots. That was the board saying you have to call a new election because the fraud may have overturned the results of the election where the Republican narrowly won. And then we found out, Wendy, that the Republican isn't running. So we still don't have anyone seated in North Carolina.
That's right. In fact, the Republican was one of the people who, after all this damaging testimony at the hearings about how he allowed the absentee ballot fraud to happen.
We're talking about Dan McCready.
Yes, Dan McCready. Mark Harris, the Republican, decided not to run. He decided not to run again. I mean, it's a really interesting case because, you know, the man's son, who was an assistant U.S. attorney, and if you're going to have a kid who's a lawyer, you might as well listen to him on legal advice. The kid told him not to hire this guy, that this guy was a fraud and was dangerous. And it's just a really interesting look at how a Republican state is handling election fraud.
Anita Kumar, we've heard the name McCray Dallas, who was operating in this race. He was the operative who apparently orchestrated the illegal collection and maybe tampering, maybe just tossing away of absentee ballots that might be Democratic votes. He's in some trouble now as well.
He's in some trouble. Also, Mark Harris is in some trouble because people are saying that even though he says he didn't know what this person was doing, that he got warned and he might have perjured himself when he said he wasn't warned about this. So, I mean, I don't think even though there's going to be a new race, I don't think we've seen the end of perhaps the legal case here. What's really interesting about this case is that Republicans, we've been hearing this in the Trump era and even before, Republicans always talk about voter fraud. This is a different kind of voter fraud than they've been talking about. They say people are illegally voting, right? People that are illegal immigrants or other people that shouldn't be voting are voting. But this is actually someone on the Republican side who falsely put absentee ballots out there, made up people, put other people. So it's a different kind of fraud. And people are saying, where's the fraud that the Republicans were talking about?
Yeah, this is not the kind of fraud that voter ID would help. This is taking fraudulently the votes of qualified American voters and manipulating, tossing, ruining them.
Right.
because they might not be for your side. We have a couple of stories on immigration that I want to make sure we get to, because there was so much going on behind the scenes. I shouldn't say behind the scenes, also going on while the Michael Cohen testimony was going on. It was very easy to miss. But a Justice Department report was released by Congressman Ted Deutch, a Democrat of Florida, that said the government received more than 4,500 complaints in 4 years about the sexual harassment and abuse of immigrant children at American detention facilities. Shane Harris, tell us more about this report. That line I just mentioned is shocking.
Yeah, it's really shocking. So this measures these referrals of these cases. And of those, about 1,300 or so of the 4,500 allegations that you mentioned of abuse of children in these detention facilities were referred to DOJ, Department of Justice. And of those, 178 were found to be actual adult staff members that it had sexually assaulted immigrant children. And the remainder were allegations of minors assaulting other minors, which, of course, then speaks to the security within the facility as well. So you've got these two problems of one, the abuse by children against children, but maybe even more seriously, these people who are in charge of the facilities doing this. And what they found was that the number of complaints rose after the Trump administration enacted its forced separation policy, so taking away minor children from their parents at the border or children who were unaccompanied and putting them in these detention facilities.
Now, the government says these are just allegations. The vast majority of these reports are unfounded. They don't point to actual abuse. Is that credible?
Well, I don't know if that's – it's hard to know from the statistics, and the reporting around this has said that some of the statistics are could be more illuminating. But it seems to me that, you know, even if you had a handful of allegations of children being sexually assaulted by the people who are supposed to be effectively are their jailers, if we want to think of it that way, that's pretty darn troubling.
Well, on the immigration story, you know, it was only a week ago. It's easy to forget that we were covering feverishly the president's – declaration of a national emergency so that he could build his border wall. And there was border wall national emergency news this week because the House voted on Tuesday to overturn President Trump's declaration. Just 13 Republicans joined almost all the Democrats, if not all, to try to block this effort to divert funding for a border wall without congressional approval. I want to play you, though, Senator Lamar Alexander. He's from Tennessee because this resolution is going to the Senate where we're going to see if Republican senators say no, Chief Executive, no, Mr. President, you cannot declare a national emergency here.
I support what the president wants to do on border security, but I do not support the way he has been advised to do it. It is unnecessary and unwise to turn a border crisis into a constitutional crisis about separation of powers when the president already has congressional funding authority to build the 234 miles of border wall that he requested in his January 6th letter to the Senate.
Wendy Benjaminson, there is a key Republican, and he's not alone, saying, I'm not down for declaring this national emergency.
That's right. And Republicans are in an interesting place here because they, you know, screamed to the high heavens when President Obama used executive action to do things that the Republican Congress wouldn't let him do. In this case, the Senate may have enough votes, probably not veto-proof, but enough votes to vote along with the House and say that this national emergency is wrong. That would be very embarrassing to the White House and to Donald Trump. He will veto it. They won't have the votes to undo it. But they're trying to stave off an embarrassing moment for the president.
If that happens, what will it say about the president's clout with Congress?
I think it's diminishing if they are able to do this.
There's another story I want to make sure we get to before we take our leave here on the Friday News Roundup, because the United Methodist Church, which has 12 million members, this is the largest Protestant denomination in the United States, voted to strengthen its ban on gay and lesbian clergy and same-sex marriages. Anita Kumar, what do we know about this latest vote?
It's really splitting the church. I mean, you've seen people come out since this vote saying, this is not the church that I want to belong to or that I want to be in. So it's really, I think there were already divisions, and this is just furthering those divisions. But, you know, as gay marriage, gay rights become just more prominent in everyday life, it has been in just recent years since gay marriage became legal. It's just sort of striking that they would take this tact. I mean, it's going the opposite direction of what society is going into if you look at polls.
I think I just said that the United Methodists are the largest Protestant denomination. They're second largest. I should point that out. Shane Harris, United Methodists, the Methodists, have a reputation for being relatively liberal in the continuum of Christian denominations, but not on this issue, or at least it's not in their hierarchy.
Yeah, you're right. And they, actually, just anecdotally speaking, friends of mine seem to be rather surprised for that very reason. They thought that maybe there was a chance that the church would be more progressive, if you want to think about it that way. You know, but the church's own membership numbers are declining. And I think what you're seeing here, and maybe it's analogous in other denominations as well, is as the numbers are declining in the United States, they may be increasing in other countries that are just generally more conservative about these kinds of issues, particularly in parts maybe of Latin America or in Africa. And that may be sort of what's driving this. I mean, while we think about this as in the United States about attitudes shifting, there are parts of the world that do make up a denomination or a membership in the denomination like this that don't see it the same way.
Right, because when you see a vote like this and you look at the trends across the rest of mainstream America, you mentioned it, Anita, you sort of say, read the room. America isn't going this way.
Right, but the world is not necessarily following where America is going.
No, they're not. That's a vote from the United Methodist Church. Well, gang, we are just about out of time, and it pains me to say so because I love having you here. But I do want to leave us on a bit of a, well, maybe a sad note, a remembrance for a small town mayor known for his doggedness. That's right, his doggedness. He was the most popular, good-natured, and fluffiest politician ever to run the 1,000-person town of Cormorant, Minnesota. That's right, I'm talking about a dog. Duke was a Great Pyrenees who won a mayoral race in the 2014 election as a write-in candidate. He went on to serve 4 terms and won every single vote in 2016 except one that went for his girlfriend, Lassie. Duke was often seen around town in an official mayor's hat and a sash. He even visited pubs and talked on local talk shows. Talked, that's right. He talked on local talk shows. Unfortunately, Duke won't get a chance to visit our show. He will not be a guest next week. Duke died last week at the healthy age of 13. That's 91 in dog years. Mayor Duke, we will miss you. I want to thank all of my guests today. Shane Harris is an intelligence and national security reporter with the Washington Post, a Luke Perry fan, or so we've learned. He's also a fellow at New America. Shane, thanks for being here.
Thanks,
Todd. Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, I thank you.
Thanks.
Wendy Benjaminson, tax editor with Bloomberg. Great to see you again. Wendy, thanks for being here.
Great to see you too.
Great to see all of you. It warms my heart when familiar faces come for the Friday News Roundup. We'll turn to the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. You'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, Babbel.com, to try Babbel for free.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Jobs Friday. Find out how the labor market changed this past month at the Indicator podcast from Planet Money on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson. President Trump returns home with no North Korean nuclear deal in hand after a failed summit in Vietnam. He and his supporters, however, are casting his empty-handed return as evidence of the president's legendary negotiating expertise.
I am always prepared to walk. I'm never afraid to walk from a deal.
In other parts of the world, Pakistan takes steps to defuse heightened tensions with India. Israel's attorney general says he plans to indict Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on corruption charges, and the UK's Brexit turmoil upends longtime party loyalties in that country. It's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. Let's get right to it. President Trump went to Vietnam this week for a second summit with North Korea's dictator Kim Jong-un, and my guests to talk about it are Natan Gutman, I've gotten that wrong before. He's Washington correspondent for Israeli Public TV. When you're Israeli, it's Natan.
Exactly.
We got you. Nancy Youssef is also here, national security reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back, Nancy.
Great to be with you.
Edward Luce is also here, chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. His latest book is The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you, Edward. Let's get right to it. Nick Schifrin is on the line. He's foreign affairs and defense correspondent for PBS NewsHour, joining from Hanoi. where he's been covering the president's summit with Kim Jong-un. Nick, give us the highlights of the summit between the president and the leader from your perspective.
Todd, thanks for having me. I think there's two takeaways, mainly now that we're about 24 hours out from this summit. One is the United States, President Trump, walked away from its stated policy of staged negotiations, staged progress with North Korea. Senior officials have been talking publicly for weeks and privately for months about a slow process toward denuclearization, admitting it was going to take a long time, admitting that they were not going to demand front-loaded concessions by North Korea, things like an inventory of weapons, and were not going to bring the tone that some U.S. officials had in the past of demanding lots of actions by North Korea before the U.S. made actions. And instead, what we saw yesterday morning here was a decision by the president, the secretary of state, and the national security advisor who was in the room to demand more, to really push North Korea a little farther. We can talk about details of that. And number two takeaway is that despite that, no bridges were burned. And the reason is, one, the president's tone in that press conference that we saw was very positive and urging Kim Jong-un to continue talking and saying nice things about Kim, including about human rights, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but also the North Koreans. While there were some initial reports at a press conference they had about some snide comments about the president, more important, according to North Korea watchers, is the official statement that's come out about the summit in the last few hours, and it was very positive. It was did not dwell on the fact that there was no deal. It dwelled instead on the relationship between Kim Jong-un and President Trump and suggested that the North Koreans were looking forward to more dialogue.
Nick, the top line coming from both sides when the summit broke up, from the American side, we just weren't going to give total sanctions relief for what the North Koreans were offering in terms of disarmament and denuclearization. And from the North Koreans, we didn't want total sanctions relief. That's not true. We wanted partial and we didn't get enough. Do we have any sense of whether that line from two, frankly, invested parties here, to say the least, is actually the reason the parties walked away?
Yeah, I think there's agreement that there was a disagreement, and that's where the agreement ends, so to speak. And so what the U.S. has said, what the president said, by the way, the Secretary of State did not use this language, but the president suggested that the North Koreans requested the removal of all sanctions. And there are almost a dozen sanctions on North Korea going back more than a decade, and they're pernicious. And they really restrict any kind of economic growth and economic relationship with the rest of the world. So you heard President Trump there saying they requested all of them. We heard from the North Koreans last night saying, no, it wasn't all of them. It was only 5 out of 11. A senior administration official has come out in the last couple hours and said, look, yes, it wasn't all of them. But from the U.S. perspective, it was all of them except for arms. And so it was worth, quote, billions and billions of dollars. And what the U.S. is saying is saying, yes, we admit it wasn't all of them. But if we had given in to this demand, we would basically be bankrolling North Korea while they didn't follow through with complete denuclearization. And so that's the U.S. line. The bottom line is the president was incorrect when he said they demanded all the sanctions. But from the U.S. perspective, there was at least the sanctions specifically requested were large enough to convince the U.S. side that it wasn't a good deal.
And Nick, there were some stories around the fringes of this widely covered summit as well. Kim Jong-un took a question from a foreign reporter. What longtime Korea watchers say is a first for him. He doesn't have a lot of press conferences. He certainly doesn't take badgering questions from Americans or anybody else outside of the state media in North Korea. I imagine you were there. What was it like?
Well, it's this extraordinary moment, and I should admit, obviously, I wasn't in the room. The reporters in the room were in the White House pool. But, you know, we give credit to the reporters in the room who kept on asking Kim questions. They asked in Singapore. He didn't answer. I think they asked very quickly the night before. He didn't answer the morning of. And then suddenly in the afternoon, there was a question to him. Are you committed to denuclearization? And actually, the president was quite uncomfortable with it. He turned to the reporter and kind of looked at him. But then Kim just started answering. And he said this amazing line, "I wouldn't be here if I wasn't," meaning I wouldn't be here if I wasn't serious about denuclearization. And the president kind of saw that and perked up and said, "Well, what a great answer." And then he was asked another question. "Well, you know, what are you willing to do?" And then he said, "Well, this is why we're here negotiating." And so it is an amazing thing to see Kim Jong-un do that. I should say his father, Kim Jong-il, did some interviews with Western press. So it's not totally unprecedented for a North Korean leader to answer questions, but it's certainly the first time we've seen Kim Jong-un do this. And a sign, according to the North Korean experts who are kind of pro-engagement, you know, that Kim is different than his father and grandfather, and maybe is genuinely interested in making a deal.
Nick Schifrin is foreign affairs and defense correspondent for PBS NewsHour, frequent guest here on the Friday News Roundup. Nick, thanks for your reporting from Hanoi and from the summit. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
That's Nick Schifrin. All right, gang, around the table here. You heard Nick's report. What about going forward? He mentioned some of the dynamics, Nancy Youssef, between the United States and North Korea, and now the sort of warm, dulcet tones of the statements going forward. What about maximum pressure? That was the branding of American strategy toward North Korea to get them to the table. Do we go back to that now, or has the president's opportunity for maximum pressure passed?
So a couple of things. There are a few sort of data points we'll be watching for in the next few days. And what we're really trying to determine is, will there be signals that talks resume between lower level officials to sort of sort out these details and differences? Will we see an administration that is perhaps nervous that the North Koreans are no longer serious about denuclearization? Or will we reach a stalemate? And so one of the things that will determine that is if there's a date set for future talks between Stephen Began, the person in charge for the United States, and the North Koreans. I would point out, though, that one of the key things that still happens is that there is no freeze on production for the North Koreans. So time is on their side. And that is, if there's a stalemate or there are prolonged talks, they can still develop their program. And so from their perspective, there is no need to rush because they are still able to work on their program. There is nothing in these talks that has precluded that. And in fact, they're able to do it while getting legitimacy on the world stage.
Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire, writes to that point, Kim Jong-un is playing Trump for all he can get. Trump has elevated Kim from an erratic, noisy dictator to the world stage. Now Kim can simply use the same tactics he's always used to string Trump along. Ed Luce, it goes to what Nancy was just saying. The president has said over and over, as long as there's no testing, no nuclear testing, no missile testing, I'm happy. That does not include what many suspect, what intelligence officials know, which is North Korea continues to enrich, continues to develop behind the scenes.
And indeed has other enrichment sites that are being discovered, as well as expanding its missile program. Look, I think the best perspective of this is to compare Singapore summit 10 months ago with Hanoi. After the Singapore summit, Trump announced that he had got Kim to agree all the things Kim actually hadn't agreed to. And so Trump's people, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and others, his special envoy in North Korea, then spent the next 10 months mostly being rebuffed by Kim, trying to get Kim to agree to the things Trump said he'd already agreed to. So that put Kim in a very strong position with Trump, who also signaled that this was a desperately important deal for him to win. He asked Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, to nominate him for a Nobel Peace Prize, again, for a deal that hasn't happened. And so Kim, knowing all this, just how invested and publicly exposed Trump is in getting a deal, walked into the Hanoi negotiations with extraordinary leverage, all of which had been gifted to him by President Trump. So I think that's the perspective. Does it suggest that he will now go back to Rocket Man, fire and fury rhetoric, as opposed to, you know, we're in love? I don't think so yet, but that's just my hunch. I think Trump's too invested.
We have some news just as we're in the studio here. As we know, President Trump praised Kim as a sharp and a real leader, despite his reputation as a brutal autocrat. Now, a lot of Americans, and not just Democrats, many, many Republicans, including Nikki Haley, Kevin McCarthy, and Congress conservatives, voiced their opposition and their outrage after the president praised Kim Jong-un and sort of gave him a pass on the issue of American college student Otter Warmbier. He was arrested in North Korea, and he died shortly after being returned to the United States in a coma.
But Otto came back in a condition that was just terrible. And I did speak about it, and I don't believe that he would have allowed that to happen. It just wasn't to his advantage to allow that to happen. Those prisons are rough. They're rough places, and bad things happened. But I really don't believe that he was, I don't believe he knew about it.
Natan Gutman, the president, says he takes Kim Jong-un at his word that he had nothing to do with the torture and death of American Otter Warmbier. And now Otto's parents are speaking out. What do we know?
It's definitely in the last couple of hours we're hearing the Warmbier family, Fred and Cindy, they put out a statement basically saying, Kim and his evil regime are responsible for the death of our son, for unimaginable cruelty and inhumanity. And this is a direct rebuke of the president. We can recall that the Warmbier family was actually President Trump's guest at the State of the Union a year ago. Trump prides himself in getting Otto Warmbier back to the United States. But still, the fact that he chose to clear Kim Jong-un from any responsibility did bring the Warmbier family to speak out against it. And it kind of reminds us of the Helsinki summit with President Putin, where he stood up and said, I believe Vladimir Putin when he says that they didn't get involved in the U.S. elections. So there's this pattern here of taking the side of the foreign leader.
He said a similar thing about Mohammed bin Salman, who now leads Saudi Arabia, right, in his role in ordering the torture and death of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. There are other examples. The president said a similar thing about Roy Moore, a Senate candidate from Alabama, after credible allegations that he molested children many years ago in Alabama. The president has a personal habit of saying he takes the man in all these cases at their word that they had nothing to do with it. He says he's innocent, so I'm going to go with that. That might be a personal tick, but what does it mean in terms of American diplomacy, American posture towards North Korea, and Americans' at least pretense of being the world leader in human rights?
Well, I think it's important in that context because it basically means that at least in this negotiation with North Korea, basically President Trump is saying we're putting the whole human rights issue on the side. It's not a problem for us. And it's the same as we've seen with Saudi Arabia with the murder of Khashoggi. So basically the United States is saying we're willing to negotiate on many things, but we're not worried about the human rights issues. It goes back to China, also goes back to many other cases. And of course, for the international campaign for human rights and this attempt to bring leaders like Kim Jong-un to pay the price for their actions, this is definitely a blow.
There used to be a cost if you were negotiating with the United States, or at least it was on the table with every negotiation if you were Saudi Arabia, maybe, or China, or Vietnam, for that matter, or North Korea, that if you wanted to come to the table with the United States of America, your human rights record was on the table and you're going to have to deal.
Or even the Soviet Union back in the days, that was one of the issues that the United States insisted on in negotiating. So definitely that was an issue. To be honest, realpolitik always took the first place, and leaders were always willing to kick aside human rights issues when needed. But here it seems that overtly President Trump is saying that's not an issue for us.
I said at least pretense, and pretense does play a role in diplomacy. It appears that pretense, for better or for worse, has been put to the side. I want to move us to the border between India and Pakistan and the disputed region of Kashmir, a flashpoint for many, many decades, a deadly place for many, many decades between these two nuclear powers. But while President Trump and Kim Jong-un were negotiating in Hanoi, Edward Luce, a very, very troubling development between two nuclear powers in a situation that might be maybe more immediately worrisome than an armed Kim Jong-un.
Yes, I mean, you could make the case that a weakened Pakistan, nuclear Pakistan, is more dangerous than an emboldened, stronger North Korea in terms of global peace. You know, this began with this terrorist attack, this suicide attack on Indian paramilitary forces in Kashmir, in Jammu and Kashmir, which killed 40 of them, and alleged by the Indians to have been carried out by the terrorist group Jaish-e-Mohammed, which is based in Pakistan, which Pakistan claims to have shut down, but it's a sort of nudge-wink situation where it hasn't really. It then resulted in Indian punitive strikes across the border, which they claimed hit the Jaish-e-Mohammed terrorist camp, which the Pakistanis claimed just caused some craters in the ground, completely differing narratives from India and Pakistan. Pakistan then said two jets were shot down, both pilots captured. It turned out to be one jet, one pilot, and that pilot, Wing Commander Vardhman, has just been handed over today at Wagah, the famous border crossing between India and Pakistan, which gives some hope that this situation might be beginning to defuse. But I would sort of underline some hope, because we've got an Indian general election coming, beginning in April. It happens in several stages. Narendra Modi, the Hindu nationalist Indian prime minister, his entire persona is based on being tough and a strong leader, and particularly tough on Pakistan. And he's taken a real hit with this episode. He's seen to have not shown the kind of spine that his reputation would imply. And therefore, the temptation for him to go back to punitive measures on Pakistan, whether it's cross-border strikes or something else, that's going to remain there. This crisis is not over.
To impress voters, tensions are very high. We got this message from Sher Khan on Twitter, who says, "I am of Pakistani origin, and I believe people on both sides must ask a valid question. Indians should ask why 300 kilograms of RDX, which is a type of explosive used in the Kashmir attack, made it to its destination without getting tracked. And Pakistanis should ask why a 6-plus-minute intrusion by Indian warplanes was allowed without a response." And I think those questions point to the deadly, deadly tensions, Nancy Yusuf.
Well, it's interesting because there was an attempt by both sides to sort of demonstrate a show of force with aerial dogfights and strikes and taking captives and all the events that we saw this week, but not lead to escalation. And with every event, there was an increased risk of miscalculation. And so that's what we saw play out this week. So in addition to sort of the politics that are at play, none of the underlying issues that spurred this crisis to begin with have been addressed. And so we, as of this hour, with the return of the pilot and sort of the diffusion of tensions, we've seen a de-escalation, but that doesn't mean we've seen a resolution to the issues at hand. And so this portends of eruptions of tensions in the days and the weeks and the months ahead, because we're talking about macro issues like, what role does Pakistan have in sponsoring terrorism? What is the world's response going to be with it? How do we deal with some of the underlying issues vis-a-vis Kashmir? None of those have been addressed. It's been both sides demonstrating they don't want war, but they don't want to be underestimated either.
Natan, sometimes, and unfortunately there are examples before this, violence between these two countries over Kashmir, as Nancy says, can take on somewhat of a pro forma quality. And it's difficult to say that if somebody gets killed, but sometimes it is pro forma flexing. Nobody wants a wider war. Do you agree that that's what this was, except a particularly muscular flex? Or is there real danger, as Ed says, with elections coming up, that this could spill over?
I think there is danger because of the posturing of both leaders. And it's interesting to look at the differences. Well, Modi seems to be taking on this very military posture, in a sense, saying we're going to take these preemptive actions as needed whenever we have information that Pakistan is supposedly sponsoring terrorism against us. On the other hand, Imran Khan seemed to be, at least at the final phase of this little skirmish, he seemed to be more on the de-escalating side of the debate. He was the one who wanted to get the pilot back into India instead of keeping him in Pakistan. So I'm not sure the interests are the same right now, but it's enough for one side to seek escalation for this thing to get out of control.
Let's turn west for a moment, head west a couple of hundred miles to Iran, because earlier this week, major news inside Iran that I think a lot of Americans missed with all the news here, that Iran Foreign Minister Javad Zarif resigned from his position, or at least he tried to resign. And Nancy Yusuf, why did Zarif try to resign? Why is he back? What's going on inside the leadership of Iran right now?
So it was a very dramatic week. On Instagram, he posts a message saying that he had resigned. This was around the same time that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had traveled to Iran and met with top officials sans him. And then under Iranian law, it has to be accepted by the leadership. It was not. And then over the course of several days, we heard from some of the most influential people, religious figures, as well as Soleimani, sort of speaking out in support of him. And rather than resigning, he essentially emerged as a stronger foreign minister. And so he comes out of this stronger from a threat.
But Nancy, what's the drama here? Why the attempt to resign? What's going on among the hardliners in Iran? And Zarif is often cast as more moderate toward the West, toward the United States. What's the tension?
So his resignation really threatened the Rouhani government, which, by the way, is battling hyperinflation and real tensions, but also emboldening the hardliners who really hold him as responsible for the Iran deal, which some had hoped would lead to economic prosperity and, in fact, has led, some would argue, to economic stagnation with the increased sanctions.
And sanctions are back.
That's right. And so that was sort of the domestic politics at play. Now, in interviews he's given to semi-official news outlets, he has said he wanted to reassert the foreign ministry's position, given that it had been, according to Soleimani, unintentionally snubbed at this visit. I think what we heard was somebody who was frustrated that his only place was to be the very charming and very effective voice of Iran overseas, but not being included in the Rouhani government in key decisions, key meetings within his own country. And so I think he did what all of us, I guess, have threatened to do at some point, of resign and show them how much we're valued. And he was able to really do that because he heard around the country, you heard people really concerned about the prospect of him leaving. We can't underestimate how effective he has been at being the voice of Iran overseas. When you watch him interview here, this is someone who earned his graduate degree in the United States. He is a master at presenting the Iranian position.
One country that is watching Iran and its national security machinations very closely is Israel. And Natan, I'm glad you're here because Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is now, we know, going to be indicted on charges of bribery and fraud. This news was confirmed yesterday by the country's attorney general. The prime minister's political party, known as Likud, they're on the right. They described the decision as political persecution. I think I also saw the Hebrew translation of witch hunt in a statement. Maybe you can bring us up to speed on that. A subversion of Israeli democracy. Bibi Netanyahu in the dock.
Definitely. Although it is important to note that the way the Israeli legal system works, there's still one more stage before Bibi Netanyahu actually gets indicted and goes on trial, and that is this hearing. After the Attorney General Mandelblit announced that he actually wrote a 57-page letter explaining the indictment, now Netanyahu's lawyers get a chance to have a hearing with the AG and to present whatever legal points they have to convince him to not to put the final stamp on the indictment. Now, this is where the timing becomes interesting because it will take them 3, 4, 5, 6 months to prepare this hearing, and we have elections coming up in 5 weeks, which means that Netanyahu will be going to the Israeli public on April 9th with an indictment hanging over his head, but it's not final yet. And that's why we saw Netanyahu yesterday basically in the speech in which he used the term a witch hunter, the Hebrew equivalent of that. And of course, he attacked the judiciary system and the media and the left that are out to get them. And these themes, I'm sure, sound very familiar to people over here. But basically what he said is, when you go to vote on April 9th, keep in mind that this is not a final decision yet. So I'm still innocent. And that's what he would like voters to know.
He has reached out to some very hardline, very right wing, very hardcore members of a coalition now in the Israeli right to sort of solidify his political base. Is that likely to work? Is he likely to survive here?
Well, there are two issues here. First of all, there's the corruption issue, and will it cost him any votes in the Israeli public? Probably not so much. Netanyahu's base of supporters knows about these issues. These investigations are going on for years. It probably won't make a major difference for them. But his main threat politically is from the center. This new centrist party that just emerged, made of up of former generals, that seemed to take a central line on most issues. And that's why Netanyahu is kind of concerned politically. And that's the reason behind this this alliance that he formed with an extreme right-wing government party, which is basically the followers of the racist Kahana movement.
Yeah.
And he got a lot of criticism over that here in the United States and at home, but it will help him solidify the right-wing base.
You're saying that is Israelis' perception of years of investigations, potential corruption, wrongdoing by their leader, and investigations is sort of baked into their evaluation of their leader. Sounds familiar.
Yeah, definitely. And maybe we should remind what are we talking here about. One of the cases is that Netanyahu and his wife got cases and cases of champagne and expensive cigars from billionaires, which in return Netanyahu provided them or allegedly provided them with all kind of favors. And in two of the other cases, there were basically cases of Netanyahu seeking favorable media coverage by promising the owners of these media outlets all kind of benefits that he could.
Charges of corruption, the possibility that Benjamin Netanyahu will face bribery charges and corruption charges just after his election later on this spring. That's Natan Gutman of Israeli Public TV. Nancy Youssef is here. Ed Luce is here as well. We're going to take a break. But first, a goodbye to a member of a legendary English rock band. Drummer Andy Anderson played with The Cure in the early 80s. He was with Iggy Pop, with the Sex Pistols, Peter Gabriel, Isaac Hayes, all of your favorites. Anderson died this week. He was 68, and tributes from his former bandmates are pouring in, remembering his musical contributions on songs like The Love Cats by The Cure. Here it is. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Sam Sanders here. Every week on my show, It's Been a Minute, two journalists and I reflect on the news and culture of the week. Because when the news is this complicated, it really helps to just talk it out. Catch up with us on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
It's the Friday News Roundup, the Global Edition. A top cardinal in Australia is convicted of sex abuse, and Venezuela's leading opposition figure tries to rally support in Brazil. We will get to those stories before the end of the show, I'm sure, but Ed is here, and we must talk about Brexit. As the Brits are fond of saying, we are rather up against it, I'm afraid, with Brexit. Ed already knows that. This week, French President Macron warned that France might not agree to a request that could come from the UK to delay the terms of a Brexit divorce. Now, earlier, Prime Minister Theresa May conceded that if the House of Commons again votes down her deal to leave Brexit, she will be looking at asking Europe for more time. That's an alternative to what they call, what is it, Ed, a no-deal Brexit,
right?
Indeed. A no-deal Brexit. So, Ed, if I gave you $100, 73 pounds, is that what you would prefer, to bet on the outcome right now? We've tried this with some of your fellow countrymen on this show before to predict just where this mess is going. Tell me where we're at and how you're going to get your 73 pounds off me to predict where this is going to be in a month.
I'll take it in euros.
Okay.
Oh,
that's ironic.
Look, up until a few weeks ago, I had a pretty strong hunch how this was going to end up. And for the first time, really, since the process began, I think that there's no clear instinct that isn't going to make you look anything other than foolish if you make a hard prediction. This is the most fluid situation we've seen yet. And that means that we've got another British word, an omni-shambolic politics in Parliament at the moment, where there's no consensus behind any of the sort of three clearest options, you know, one of which is a hard no-deal Brexit, another of which is Theresa May's plan, which has already been heavily defeated once earlier this year in Parliament, and the third of which is to have a so-called people's vote, a second referendum, with one of the options being to actually remain in Europe, having, you know, been educated over the last 2.5 years about the costs of leaving, to give the option to the second chance, the people the second chance on that. In 2 weeks' time, May is going to have three key votes in the House of Commons. The first vote is on her plan, expected to be defeated again heavily. Next day, on March the 13th, she'll have a vote on whether Parliament wants to have a hard no-deal exit. Again, expected to be heavily defeated. That's clear. Most people don't want that. Some do. Some of the hard Brexiteers don't, but that'll be defeated. Third is to extend Article 50, which is the divorce agreement, which provides for Britain to leave on March the 29th, come what may, no pun intended. And that would be to give Britain another 3 months. And what Macron is saying, and other Europeans, is, look, if you don't know what you're going to do with those 3 months, why should we give you this extension, this delay of stay of execution, if you like, unless we know you've got a credible plan? Maybe it's to hold a referendum. Maybe, you know, it's to reach consensus on joining, remaining in the European Customs Union, so the Irish border question doesn't arise. But right now, Theresa May has given no indication of what she would do with that extra time.
If there were a vote tomorrow, put it back to the UK populace. Okay, want to change your mind? Want to remain? Would it pass?
So I think it would have to be a three-part question. One would be May's plan. Another would be, would we stay in Europe? And the third would be hard no-deal Brexit, what I call stay, May, or D-Day. it's very unclear. If you look at opinion polls, they're all over the place, what people would vote for. It would have to be a sophisticated referendum, because you wouldn't get one necessarily getting more than 50%.
Now, the ancillary political damage is raining down, not just on Theresa May, but on Jeremy Corbyn as well, all around the British government. Annie Soubry is one of about a dozen MPs who recently left their main party because of this mess and because of some other issues as well that we'll talk about. Speaking to ITV this week, Soubry cast doubt on whether a last-minute deal was even going to be possible.
The sooner that they all wake up to the varying realities of it, the better. Because the simple truth is that we are going nowhere. There is an impasse in Parliament, because for many members of Parliament, they simply will not vote to make their constituents poorer. And whichever way you cut it, that's what you get with Brexit.
A small group of British MPs, more than a dozen, however, have broken off from the Tories. They've broken off from Labour. They formed an outside, I'll call it a centrist, I don't know if that's the right framing, a group. Brexit's one of the issues, the dysfunction, but it's not the only one.
No, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, it was initially seven members of the Labour Party who formed this independent group. His leadership of the Labour Party has become more and more controversial, particularly his refusal to unequivocally condemn anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. And one of the members of Parliament, Labour members who left, was a Jewish member from Liverpool, pregnant, in fact. She said, I cannot remain a part of a party that is attacking me for being Jewish. And Corbyn has still yet to unequivocally draw a line that this is intolerable. This week, one of his senior members of Parliament, a guy called Chris Williamson, said that in public, Labour had been too apologetic about its anti-Semitism. The outcry then forced Corbyn to suspend Chris Williamson's membership of the Labour Party and investigate him. But again, very grudgingly, very half-heartedly, and only after having been forced to. So there is this bizarre and persistent strain of around this sort of cult leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, of far left tendencies that sort of spill over into far right ones, such as anti-Semitism, which is an added sort of toxic layer to this already omni-shambolic situation.
Ed, we're going to move on from this, but there's a cliche in politics. I usually shy away from them, but it's apropos here. Can the center hold, which might be one of the conceptual questions behind this Brexit mess? There doesn't seem to be any consensus around a center, and like so many things in American politics, I look at the UK and I don't know where the center is anymore.
Yeah, and appropriately, that's a line, now things fall apart, the center cannot hold, from an Irish poet, Yeats, because Ireland, of course, would be one of the principal victims of a hard Brexit. The answer is, I don't know, but I think if there were a simple question, way of framing this is, would you prefer to be a bitterly divided country in Europe or out of Europe? There is no solution that involves Britain not being bitterly divided.
Let's stay in the Commonwealth. We'll leave the UK, but we'll stay in the Queendom for the moment, because Australian Cardinal George Pell, he's the most senior bishop to be convicted of sexual abuse to date. He was taken into custody in Australia Wednesday to await his sentencing. The 77-year-old priest and advisor to the Pope was found guilty on 5 counts of sexual assault by a unanimous jury in December against 2 13-year-old choir boys in 1996. As Cardinal Pell was being escorted out of the courtroom, he was met met with a passionate crowd who had some strong remarks for him. Now, this case was truly unique, not because of George Pell's very high ranking in the Catholic Church, Nancy, but under Australian law, survivors of the assault were prohibited from identifying themselves or speaking out publicly about their experiences. This issue comes up just about every week, whether it's Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Massachusetts, all around this country. Let's go to Australia. Let's go to Rome itself. Let's go around the world as the Catholic Church continues to, I would say, begin to reckon with the legacy of the abuse and torture of children by its most senior cardinals now.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because this was all happening as Pope Francis had pulled together a group of members at the Vatican to discuss this very issue, as the former cardinal and archbishop here in Washington was defrocked. And so you see a Catholic Church that is sort of taking steps to try to address this issue. And at the same time, you're through this verdict and the conviction this week, the impact. I mean, Cardinal Bell was someone who wasn't just, as you mentioned, the highest ranking. He was also very much revered within Australia. This was someone who was awarded the Order of Australia in 2005, who was held up as a public figure. And so we're seeing, I think, this push-pull, and that is reconciling what the past means and trying to address how the Catholic Church moves forward in the future. And I think that was really reflected this week in this case and what we saw out of the Vatican. Now, the other interesting development, and you made reference to this, was the suppression order, which meant that while we've been able to talk about this case, it was not publicly discussed in Australia at all. There was an order that was a gag order, essentially, on the case. And so Australians are really first talking about this publicly this week, because the prosecutors essentially announced they weren't going to pursue second charges related to this case, which meant that there was no threat to a future case, which removed the gag order. And so you can see Australians really reconciling this in a very public way that wasn't allowed to happen up until this week. Now, he will be sentenced next month, and I think we'll see, we're going to continue to see sort of steps along with the Catholic Church, whether it's enough, whether they're able to do it in such a way that sort of reconciles the image of the Catholic Church remains to be seen. But it was an interesting dichotomy this week of between what was happening in the Vatican and what was happening in Australia.
The image of the Church and whether they can reconcile in a way that begins to approach compensation for the thousands and thousands and thousands of victims, not just in the United States, but around the world. Ed, I'm sorry to say that this is not the last time I'm going to predict that we'll be talking about a story like this. I don't know if we'll ever go higher than Cardinal George Pell, but we've certainly gone as high as Cardinal Bernard Law of the Archdiocese of Boston, now who has moved on from this world. And I think it's not the last conversation we're going to have.
I suspect we're going to be having many, and I suspect that Pope Francis is going to be having more too, because this conference he held was considered unsatisfactory, really, across all sides. He didn't lay down a Vatican line that this will be zero tolerance, that this will be, a global policy emanating from Rome. He offered autonomy for different reactions and different solutions in different dioceses and different cardinalships in different parts of the world. And that was considered to be a fudge. I don't think he's cleared the air. I don't think he's changed the direction. And I think he's going to have to go back to this issue. So it's not just us who's going to be discussing it. It's the Pope.
He'll have many more opportunities to come back to the issue, and his constituents will demand it. I predict that. Just about every week we have something to say about the crisis in Venezuela, and this week is no different, gang. Juan Guaido, who's Venezuela's self-proclaimed interim president, was in Brazil this week meeting with that country's leader, Jair Bolsonaro, the newly installed president of Brazil. Natan, did Guaido accomplish anything, any alliances with his visit to Brazil?
Well, I think he did. There are already 50 nations around the world that recognize Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. And having Bolsonaro, who's a very forceful leader in Brazil, behind him definitely helps it. And he arrived in Brazil from the meeting of the Lima conference, which took place actually in Colombia, where he heard, again, a lot of support from the international community, a pledge to continue the pressure on the government of Nicolas Maduro. But at the same time, we're talking only about economic pressure, the idea of any kind of military intervention is off the table. So in that sense, definitely Guaido has international support. But where does he take it from here? He goes back to Caracas and he promised that he will, even though there is always this threat of Maduro arresting him. But what does he do next? How do you translate this international pressure into actually changing the regime?
Well, Peggy writes to us from Tacoma Park in Maryland. I oppose Maduro and deplore how his authoritarian government has wrecked Venezuela. But the politicization and humanitarian aid by the United States and other nations seems wrong. Well, Juan Guaido was not the only person who was putting pressure on Nicolas Maduro this week, because one of our own, Jorge Ramos, said that he and his Univision crew were detained in Venezuela after an interview with Nicolas Maduro. In a video posted to the Facebook page Real America with Jorge Ramos, Ramos said he asked Maduro about reports of torture and various human rights abuses and other allegations.
And at the end, I showed him a video that I personally took last Sunday of three kids behind a trash truck looking for food. And he just couldn't stand it. He didn't want to continue the interview. He tried to close my iPad where I showed him the video. And then he said the interview was over. It was about 17 minutes of interview.
Nancy Yusuf, that was not the end of the story for Jorge Ramos.
Well, let me just say that interview began. The first question was, are you a president or a terrorist? So that gives you a sense of sort of the tenor going into it. And then 17 minutes later, as he explains what happened. So after that, they took their cameras, they took their cell phones. They were detained for 2 hours. They eventually, only he got his cell phone back. His crew did not. They did not get the cameras back. And they put them in a hotel where they had guards outside of their room to ensure that on Tuesday morning that the only place they went to was to the airport and out of the country. And so it was a dramatic end to, I think, a dramatic interview.
We're glad that Jorge is okay. He came out of it all right. He doesn't have First Amendment rights in Venezuela, I suppose. His rights tarnished, but his person and the persons of his crew, all okay.
That's right. But the interview we will never get to see because they've taken it.
They've taken it. Well, I had some sympathy for Jorge Ramos. I, too, have been isolated and questioned by Venezuela's goons, not by Nicolas Maduro, but by the government of his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. It was many years ago, they found out that I was a journalist and my traveling companion were journalists, and they paid us a visit in the hotel. This thing is real. We just about have to go, guys, but I want to leave us on a very inspiring and bright note out of Japan. An infant in Tokyo went home from the hospital with his family this week. Maybe that's not such big news, but this baby was born in August by emergency C-section at a birth weight of 268 grams. That's 9.5 ounces, just over half a pound. A can of Campbell's soup weighs more than that, and it's right around the average weight of an adult hamster. But with intensive care, medical treatment, and a lot of his family's love, that baby not only survived, but was determined to be healthy enough to go home. He now holds the record for smallest baby born on record to be discharged from a hospital on this very planet. And in case you're curious, he's now 7 pounds and feeling very, very well and appears to be very healthy. I don't know if babies bounce in Japan, but I think this one might be a bouncing baby. That's according to the BBC, and we're very, very happy to hear it. I'm very, very happy to have all of you around the table with me. I want to thank you, Nancy Yusuf, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Great to be with you.
Ed, thank you for your Brexit guidance. As always, much appreciated.
Pleasure to be here.
U.S. columnist and commentator of the Financial Times, author of The Retreat of Western Liberalism, and Natan Gutman, Washington correspondent for Israeli Public TV. Thank you for bringing us up to speed on Bibi Netanyahu. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It is distributed by NPR. 1A senior team are Lindsay Foster Thomas, Danielle Knight, Denise Couture, and Gabe Bullard. Our lead engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical support from Josephine Neonai. This episode was edited by Miranda Fillmore. I'm Todd Zwillick. I want to wish you a very, very great weekend. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.